You're listening to Nick Luck Daily, bringing you the latest news and the best interviews from around the world of horse racing. This episode is brought to you by the Racehorse Owners Association, by Thoroughbred Racing Commentary's global rankings in partnership with the Saudi Cup, and by the Fitzdares Club.
Hello and welcome to Nick Luck Daily, the show that brings you the latest news and the sharpest insight from around the world of horse racing. I'm Tom Stanley, in for Nick, on Tuesday the 6th of April. We are but 48 hours or so away from three fantastic days up at Aintree. We missed the Grand National last year, we get it this year, and we've just had three fantastic days at Fairy House over the Easter weekend, which culminated in the Irish Grand National, and a bit of a surprise as well, and some. Jane Mangan, my guest today, was at Fairy House for all 3 days. Jane, spin me through some of your highlights.
Well, it was a meeting for everybody, and it was a showcase that racing can be conquered without mega bucks. I thought the story of Sky Ace on Sunday in the Grade 1 Novice Mare's Hurdle, £600 into a Grade 1 winner, having been fourth at Cheltenham. She's obviously tough as teak. She's quite small, but the bullishness of her trainer pre-race was, I thought, pretty refreshing. It's so unusual to get connections so forthright pre-race. And she prevailed for her trainer, Sharkhan, to give him a first Grade 1 and a first of two Grade 1s on the day for Jodie McGarvey, who we know in this country works so hard. And given the opportunity, as he did on Sky Ace and Jana Dill in the Underwriting Exchange Gold Cup, he didn't miss. And that really set the tone Saturday for what was to follow in the Grand National yesterday.
And that Irish Grand National was won by Freewheeling Dylan at just 150-1. Unbelievable stuff. For trainer Dermot McLaughlin and young rider Ricky Doyle. And I spoke to him a little bit earlier on, asking him how he felt with a night to sleep on what was the biggest win of his career.
Still numb, still kind of, every time I look at the phone, there's just mountains of texts and missed calls, and it's just mad that it has happened to me.
When you say to you, I know you didn't expect to go and ride an Irish Grand National winner, but just give us an idea about you then as a rider and sort of the last couple of years experience you've had.
The last couple of years I've been kind of, each season is getting better, and but like that, I suppose this year, I'm starting to win a bit of better races, with the Midlands National with him, and then a nice handicap in Leicestertown with a horse of Gord Loughlin's Machuca, and kind of they were fairy tale days, and to win an Irish Grand National, it's just unbelievable, and I didn't think it would ever would be me. I thought, like that, I'm turned 27 this year and I still hadn't a ride in the race, so I was just happy to have a ride in the race, and I thought that was just going to be me.
Well, you gave the outsider in the race an absolute peach. I was quite struck, Ricky, your interview on Racing TV with Gary afterwards, you saying, you know, you're 27 now, and you don't want to just be sort of a bit part rider, if you like. You kind of want to keep kicking on and keep cracking on and be riding good horses regularly. So, I mean, this is just the tonic for this year for you, isn't it?
Yeah, unbelievable. And, yeah, just like, sure, I've seen plenty of lads do it, like, they do just to earn a living. And I don't want to do that. I want to be champion jockey. I want to win every race that I ride in, like, So, like, for that to happen yesterday, that was just hopefully a stepping stone. Hopefully we can kick on and keep going for the next whatever amount of years I've left as a jockey. I never want to give up, but at the same time, there's a lot of things you can do in life that can make you happy, and I just never wanted to be unhappy doing it, so I was kind of just always well aware of that.
When we, I was watching Ricky, I think naturally when you're watching the 150-1 outsider in front, you're naturally looking behind thinking, well, what's going to come and get him? Do you feel the same when you're riding him, or did you know that you were getting a proper tune out of Freewheeling Dylan and nothing was going to catch him?
Well, I knew I was definitely getting a proper tune out of him. I was having some crack at him. Like, it was unbelievable. Like, he's jumping down the back and then down the side and then kind of jumping five out, and he winged it and then latched back onto it again. I kind of pricked my own ears and was thinking, geez, like, something serious could happen here. And like that, turning in then when the horses got to his tail and he started to pick up even more, and with the three fences of the straight, like how well he was jumping, I was thinking, geez, like, if I win these and keep quickening like this, like, it's going to take a good horse to go by him.
And nothing did. Brilliant stuff. It was great to watch, and I'm sure it was some feeling to be on his back. Ricky, well done.
Thank you. Unbelievable. Thank you so much.
Yeah, the Irish Grand National, that was just an unbelievable performance. Have you seen the Twitter video? Is it Dermot's cousin, I think, jumping around, going absolutely bananas? If nobody out there has seen it, just go find it, because it's absolutely brilliant. And it really just hits home what it means to, if you don't mind me saying, slightly smaller connections to win races like this.
Well, Dermot McLaughlin's cousin represented all of us had that been our family, because that is how you would react if you couldn't be there on the day in real time. And yes, as you say, he went forward. It was a pretty seamless run for him. His jumping was brilliant. Horses in behind, having steadied it at halfway, Ricky Doyle kind of ensured that the horses in behind are going to have to work very hard if they're going to get involved. Very few did. I think the only horse to really come from off the pace was the novice Sempo, who finished fifth for Joseph O'Brien. But no excuses for the favourite. Latest Exhibition was always handy, in a lovely position, in a good rhythm for Brian Cooper, and jumped pretty well. But Run Wild Fred and Freewheeling Dylan, they were nearly upsides for most of the journey, at 3.5 miles, 3 miles, five even. And it was an endearing story. I think he's the biggest prize winner of the Irish Grand National ever, and it just goes to show, if you have the ammunition. I think he was bought as a three-year-old for €13,000. Again, a bit like Sky Ace, it isn't a massive price tag, and it was this weekend of racing kind of gives us all a little bit of hope. You know, sometimes when the same people and the big names win everything, you kind of wonder, what am I doing and why do I bother? Well, Fairy House just goes to show, keep getting up in the morning, keep trying, keep working. And Dermot McLaughlin, I think he said he could walk the horse to the track. He is that close. So a huge local success. A pity they couldn't be there. And Ricky Doyle, you know, he's obviously a grafter. I think people say he drives the box for Conor Dwyer if he has to. He's based with Conor on the Curra. And it was really a victory for racing in a lot of intensive purposes this weekend, because there was great names, great stories, and proof that it can be done.
And now, a man that missed his ride in the Irish Grand National was Paul Townend, because of an injury he sustained, which will affect his bid to retain the Irish Jockeys Championship, Jane, and really opens the door now for Rachel Blackmore, who's 10 behind. First of all, what do we know officially? Because I was searching around yesterday, trying to find news of the injury. There was a bit of breaking news, and then it all went a little bit quiet. And I feel there's a little bit of caginess about this injury. So enlighten us, if you can. What do you know?
I love how you think I'm going to enlighten you when there's absolutely nothing concrete out there.
As if you did the x-ray, Jane. Go on.
Yes, I saw the foot myself. look, Paul is in obviously the biggest job in jump racing, and there is less than a month to the end of the season. He's 10 winners in front of Rachel Blackmore, and of course the Aintree Grand National is on Saturday. I think they're just holding on official confirmation or official news until they get a second scan. That's what my understanding is, that they want a proper CT scan to basically decipher, is it a metatarsal? Is it further up in the foot? It's his right foot. And it's obviously not good. So they're not saying anything for the reason they want to know exactly what they're going to say. Personally, I'm not going to make any speculation, but if it's a foot injury and the Grand National is less than 7 days later, it wouldn't take Einstein to know it's going to be a huge push. And William Mullins is 4 in the Aintree Grand National. Mm. But I think Paul's mind will be firmly on can Rachel Blackmore basically eat into his lead? Punchestown marks the end of the season. Can he get back to ride the likes of Shacken, Persuan and Appreciated at Punchestown? Because those horses will be short odds and they could seal the championship for him. But all eyes now will turn to Rachel Blackmore. She's going to Aintree. She's obviously got probably around 10 or 11 meetings left where she could ride, where she'll have to try and ride 10 winners to equal it or 11 winners to beat him. And that's it's a big ask, but it's not impossible. And it could be that we could have the first ever female champion of a national hunt season.
It would cap off a stunning season for her, wouldn't it? And look, I think, I think most people in racing, bar Paul Town and his team, no disrespect to Paul, would love to see it happen for obvious reasons. I think it's an interesting point you touched on with Paul there as well. It's not just about him losing the championship were he to not be able to ride again this season, which we speculate. But it's also the thought of sitting on the sidelines and watching those horses at Punchestown or in a Grand National next week that he won't be able to get on. And that won't be easy. So the championship finishes on the last day of Punchestown, so the 1st of May. Were Rachel to do it, what do you think that would mean for racing as a whole, for her to become the first female to win the Jockeys Championship?
Oh, you know, Tom, it's something that is so big that it isn't imaginable. It isn't something anybody would dream of, because nobody really, I personally never thought it would be possible. So I'm not going to go there in my mind yet, because we have a month and there's a lot to happen. And I hope we'll have news, confirmation on Paul's situation in the next couple of hours, 24 hours. And then we can start thinking. But asking a 10 winners is a lot as well. It's not a guaranteed conclusion that it's going to happen for her. So it's going to make Punchestown all the more intriguing if it comes down to the wire. Punchestown for me is looking a little bit like Cheltenham. All the horses who competed at Cheltenham were likely to line up there again. Mm. So,
can I jump in there, Jane? All the Irish horses. What about the Brits going over? This wasn't something I was planning to ask necessarily, but I did see a couple of tweets out there saying, why didn't the British run horses in the Irish Grand National? You know, 150 to 1 shot has run it. But the issue is surely, if the British can't beat the Irish in the handicaps over here when the Irish are raised for coming over, what chance do the British have of going back to Ireland?
That's a great question. Look, Jerry's back was the sole British representative for Philip Hobbs in yesterday's race. Look, you have to try. You have to try. You have to be ambitious. And we saw that in personified at the weekend. Look, Nicky Henderson's always been the chief supporter from the UK of the Punchestown Festival. And I'd love to see if he brought over Epitant for a rematch with Honeysuckle, potentially bring over Chantry House. And those horses make the festival. And I cannot emphasise enough the effect of having Sprinter Sacra at Punchestown a number of years ago. It was like, I wasn't around for Arkle or Dawn Run or any of those, but the amount of people that turned up just to see him. So look, we obviously don't have a Sprinter Sacra at the moment, but international competition is what we crave. We did get that at Cheltenham, but if you want to stand your ground, come over. We've got the prize money. And look, I know it's good for racing, and it's no good for racing that one side dominates. And obviously Cheltenham, it was a little bit of an exception to the rule, but Punchestown's got 5 days of great racing, and I'd love to see some overseas runners.
Right, one man who is lining up a few runners at Aintree this week is young Emmett Mullins, after a very successful bonus raid with the shunter at Cheltenham. He's got a couple of other runners likely to turn up at Aintree this week, and I started off earlier on by asking him which race we would see the shunter in.
The plan at the moment is we've declared this morning for the 2.5 mile novice chase. I think there's 7 runners, and it's exciting again.
I mean, he goes there off the back of Cheltenham, you'd imagine, with a pretty strong chance. Has he surprised you the way he's progressed this year? Did you think he'd end up rated what he is now at the start of the season?
Oh, no, never. He keeps improving all season, and he surprised us no end, especially in Cheltenham, looked like his best performance of the season. So, fingers crossed, he's still improving.
Now, we know that Cheltenham was obviously part of a plan, to get the bonus, etc. I mean,
how much was then coming on to Aintree part of that plan?
No, the plan had started and finished with the bonus, and so the plan's been executed. That was great, and now we're just taking everything as it comes now. There's a he's been fantastic, and so while he's in good form, we'll keep him going.
And he is, he's flying along, is he? You got a, I mean, it feels like this year there's a good break between Cheltenham and Aintree, and he's a happy horse at home.
Yes, yeah, no, I think it's 3 weeks to the day since he won in Cheltenham, so he takes his travelling well. He doesn't take much work at home to wind up, so he's I'm very happy with him. I think he's even heavier than when he travelled to Cheltenham and Cheltenham.
What else are we is likely to turn up? I see you've had a couple of other entries. Are we going to see both of them?
Yes, yeah. Cape Gentleman will travel. He won the Dovecot in Kempton. Well, I'd say we got away with the 2 mile trip that day. He's definitely a stayer. So he's in the 2.5 on Saturday and the Grand Sexton, I think, on the Friday evening. Mm. It'd be a bit of a jump from 2 miles to 3 miles, but it might just be an easier race, the 3 mile over the 2.5. There's a few nice entries there. Bally Adam and Brave Man's Game might look like the 2.5 mile race.
Was it just too close to Cheltenham, the Dovecot, that you were always going to avoid that with him and keep him for Aintree?
Yes, no. I was always planning for either Fairy House at the weekend or Aintree, and just I don't know what swayed me at the last minute, but we stuck to our guns with Aintree, and he would have had a penalty in Fairy House. It was probably the biggest deciding factor for going to Aintree. So hopefully we don't have any mishaps like we did in Leopardstown. But I think the good ground is key to him.
And if it is, you know, there's talk of not much rain. We've had the clerk of the course, Salika Varma, on this podcast yesterday talking about that and the need for watering. I mean, if you're looking at good ground, would you be more inclined as well to stick him over 3 miles?
Yes, yeah, no. I've been leaning towards the 3 mile at the moment. Good ground, he'll love it, Champs-Élysées. They really flick off the good ground, and I'd be looking forward to him. It's really exciting to see if he can progress again.
Very much so, and a bumper runner potentially.
Yes, bumper runner, the Gossiper, on Saturday. He done it nicely in Wexford. I would say he got away with the ground as well. He's a Dylan Thomas horse. He definitely wants better ground. And he shows plenty of boot at home. So, no, we're very happy with him here. And we couldn't be asking him to do anything better at home. So we have to go and take our chance.
Absolutely. You got the taste for the British Raid after Cheltenham. That was some day, wasn't it? You and the whole team seemed absolutely buzzing after that.
That's it. No, it's just exciting, even with no crowds, it still gets to you. So everyone is still floating here. So we're happy and horses seem happy. So it's a good place to be.
Emmett, thanks for your time. Look forward to seeing those runners at Aintree.
Cheers. Thanks very much.
Delighted to say we can indulge ourselves now with a trip down Grand National memory lane. And Richard Dunwoody, who won the race in 94 with Mini Homer, 8 years after his first success with West Tip. They were trying to win the race for the second time. And I started off by asking him how it felt as a then young man to win the Grand National.
Very, very long time ago now, Tom. Unbelievable. And I don't know, I think it took sort of 2 or 3 days to really sink in. We've fallen the year before, Beaches second time around. was sort of upsides in front, and it was about the only mistake he ever made around there, West Tip. But very lucky to come back and sort of redeem ourselves the next year, you know. So, yeah, an amazing feeling. At 22, I think you take it all a bit for granted. You know, it was very early in my career, but the second time around, I think I appreciated it a lot more on Mini Homer in 94.
You mentioned that the first time around, you came down at Beecher's second time. Did that mean that going to the fence then in 86, going to Beecher's second time around, you approached it a little bit differently, or was that in the back of your mind?
Yeah, I was just refreshing my memory. I haven't seen it for a little while, and just went back and watched the rerun of it. I certainly had a few horses in front of me going to Beecher's second time around in 86. Yeah, there was no way I was going to be in the same place as I had been in 85. Got a few shouts off Tom Taff as I pulled out, going to Beecher's second time around. Made sure I jumped it sort of middle to almost middle to outer. Yeah, the main thing was just not to make any stupid mistakes. The horse gave me an absolutely brilliant ride. He was, you know, virtually, by that mistake at Beecher's, he was virtually faultless around there in all his other runs, you know. So it was amazing, you know. And then he idled in front. It was always the idea to get a good lead, sort of get to the elbow. And Chris Grant and Young Driver, yeah, they gave me a great lead over the last and got there at the elbow. And he idled all the way from there probably, but just did enough. Won by a very handy two lengths.
Job done. You know, it's funny you say as a young man winning it, and I don't know if you then think it's easy enough to win a national. I mean, going into this year, Tom Scudamore was on the podcast a few days ago with Nick, just talking about how this is, I think it's nearly his 20th go, and he's yet to win it. Richard Johnson, he never won it. We know how long it took Tony McCoy to win it, and there you were at 20 to 22, thinking, well, there we are, I've won a national. But then it took you another few years to win another.
Yeah, but as I say, very lucky to team up with West Tip. Michael Oliver, you know, stood by me, and I rode him another four times, finished second, finished fourth twice. And as I say, I think having then fallen a couple of times and, you know, for the next sort of 10 years before I won on, well, it was just less than 10 years before I won on Mini Homer. But certainly by the time I sat on Mini Homer in 94, I realised just how difficult it was, what we were up against. You know, it was a huge challenge, and it was something from, you know, I was watching it as a kid in near Belfast when I was growing up there. I always used to sit at home and or try not to go to the local point of point. My parents would always want to take me off to the North Down point of point, and I'd resist and try and watch the national age 5 and 6, you know. So it just, from a really early age, it meant everything to me, the race. And yeah, it was just amazing to get the chance to ride in it, never mind win it.
I'm sure it was, you know, Mini Homer and you and Martin winning it together. Would you and whoever you rode for in any given season, would you sort of try and identify a national horse? And what type of horse was that, Richard?
Yeah, you'd... some rides came along very early, some, you know, and then obviously I was riding for the Duke and committed to Martin for two seasons. Those last few seasons I was riding freelance, and one or two of those rides I didn't get to the, you know, almost the very last minute. So you know, you'd want something. I think both of my horses that won the race were intelligent. They knew how to look after themselves around there, and certainly in those days you needed something really clever, and yeah, with a brain as well, you know. So and yeah, I was lucky to get on those two. I always remember my last ride, a horse called Call It A Day. And in a way he was almost too clever. He looked after himself, gave me an absolutely brilliant ride, but probably just didn't put it all in at the end when it all counted. But he certainly looked after me until after the winning post, actually, and then he had so much in reserve that he was able to whip round and I fell off him.
Great.
that was the end of my national rise. It's quite a almost hilarious ending to it all. But
he was quite well named then, wasn't he, in a way?
Yeah, call it a day. Yeah. I think it was the Duke's last runner and my last ride in it.
It's not just, and I know, you know, we often talk about it, it's a slightly different national nowadays, given the change in the fences. But it's not just about brute strength and stamina. But you need a horse that's switched on enough upstairs to look after himself, but not too much.
Yeah, I think that's very true. They've got to stay. That's the other thing. They've, you know, depending on the ground and everything else. And as we say, some years it can turn up on the far side and other years it can be bottomless around there. So, yeah, this time of year, you never, ever know. So it's in the lap of the gods sometimes. Mm. You know, you've got a horse that loves the top of the ground and it can go completely against him.
I remember, forgive me for saying, but Mini Homer, that little bit better than when I was far too young to remember with West Tip. But I remember much of it at the time, Mini Homer, given his owner. I mean, there was a bit of a fanfare, wasn't there, given that he was owned by Freddie Starr. Was that all part of it on the day for you?
No, luckily, I was going to say, for me, Freddie wasn't there. And, you know, so just Martin hardly said a word to me in the paddock, never said very much anyway. But so, you know, he said, you know what to do. And, you know, I'd ridden him at Newbury and knew that he also stopped in front and, you know, definitely don't get there too soon. And so the main thing was to keep horses upsize me. And get a reasonable lead. And then when Adrian jumped the last, he'd gone away. I thought he'd gone about three lengths clear of me. I thought that was it. It was all over. And then he'd stopped dead and left me in front. I thought that was nearly a disaster, just so he nearly came and beat me. But the first time I actually spoke to Freddie was after the race. Martin got a phone call just in the middle of the Desmond Lynham interview. And it was Freddie, so he was chatting away to him. I was chatting to Desmond, and then he handed me the phone. All I could hear was this very loud sort of barking sounds at the other end of the phone. Freddie was going absolutely crazy. I think he was down in Brighton. He was doing a show down there, and unbelievable. But I did get to meet him a couple of times afterwards, and to be fair, really, really, really nice guy. Mm. Yeah, enjoyed his company.
Richard, great to go down memory lane. I mean, lastly on you, we've sort of seen you do lots of international challenges all over the place recently. I take it that the current climate hasn't helped with any of those, but things are looking a bit brighter.
Yes, they're a little bit brighter, but we're based out in Spain now. I'm not too sure how long it'll be before we all get vaccinated. But hopefully the travel will start again soon. I've got a few riding holidays lined up for the summer and the autumn. So, yeah, it'd be absolutely fantastic to start travelling again. So, yeah, looking forward to it.
Pleasure to catch up. Thanks very much.
Tom, take care. Thank you.
Right, it's Tuesday, so time for the Bloodstock segment on Nick Luck Daily. Over to Nick.
It's Tuesday, so we go around the Bloodstock world on the podcast with our friends at Weatherby's and their new website, nhstallions.co.uk. And in Grand National, we're continuing the focus on Bloodstock in the National Hunt world. And we are staying in Britain today, Wales to be more precise, to Welshpool, to Yorton Farm, home to the Futter family. And David Futter, director and founder, joins us now to tell us not only about a very large burgeoning stallion roster, all of which you'll find on the Weatherby's NH Stallions website, but also about some of those ideas that he hopes will bring British breeding to greater prominence in the next few years. Dave, morning. Thanks for joining me. First of all, just tell us a little bit about the history of Yorton.
Morning, Nick. And it's very much a family-run business. We started 15 years ago, and it was two people who were the catalyst to helping us get started. Bill Bromley, his wife, who ran Wood Farm Stud, and the other was Liam and Catherine Cashman. One of us let us start to do the foaling, so we started as a foaling unit. And then Liam and Catherine kindly let us stand Revoke, and it's all grown from there, really.
Revoke, the first stallion you stood, and then more stallions started coming along, and I suppose if we're going to relativise that to a recent significant event, Honeysuckle's victory in the Champion Hurdle must have given you immense satisfaction, because she was covered by Suleimani when you began to stand him.
Liam had passed away, and the Cashman family kindly decided to carry on supporting us, and he was a stallion that I chose myself, you know, the team at Yorton chose, through Richard Benn, who helped us purchase him. And at the time, you know, when you think of his first crop, he bred Mastery as a St. Ledger winner, but as we all know, this is very much a fashion industry, and he for Flatted completely dropped him, and we thought there was an opportunity to stand him. He taught me a lot about standing stallions. I thought I knew quite a bit about standing stallions until I met Suleimani. He wasn't easy at all, Nick. He actually was a savage, and but like all these, I believed in him, and 53 this year, and I'm learning every day. And when I had Suleimani, he was difficult, was not easy to handle, and but we managed to get to a position where we both respected each other. We found out what some of his problems were, and I'm so glad that that we persevered with him. And also at the time, Sam Bullard was tremendous, and Sheikh Mohammed, because we purchased the horse, and then we realised that he wasn't the easiest to handle. We could have sent him back and had our money returned, and we just had a deal. We said, look, let's try him for 2 or 3 months, and it was fantastic. And you know, Sheikh Mohammed and Sam Bullard were brilliant in the way they conducted themselves with this, and also it gave us the time to get used to him, and the rest is history, really. He's produced some lovely horses, and I certainly was extremely upset, and it upset me for a long time when we did lose him.
He sired Honeysuckle, he sired Mastery, the St. Ledger winner. He also sired Rule the World, the Grand National winner. You'll be keeping a close eye on a few of this year's contenders, because I take a horse like Mr. Malarkey, who was conceived at Yorton Farm by Molinas from the Coles great family of Just So and Dubasilla.
Yeah, he was another stallion that the Cashman family and ourselves bought. He was, at that time, it was a lot easier to buy stallions out of France and out of different places, because at that period there weren't that many stud farms investing in National Hunt stallions, and we sort of had a free hand. And he was a horse that we liked by Lomatas, Aaron Majinski, you know, going all the way back, lovely German pedigree. He didn't really hit the buttons in France with his three-year-old horses, but often that could play to our hands over here. And then we were very fortunate. We got him bought, and the following Cheltenham Festival, he had a winner there. So he's been a really good, consistent producer of nice National Hunt horses at the graded level.
Dave, you have a number of stallions on the roster at the moment. Gentle Wave, the sire of Easy's Land, who you owned and sold on to J.P. McManus. Masterstroke, one of the best pedigrees in the book, closely related to Galileo and Black Sam Bellamy and See the Stars. Linda's Lad, still a surviving son of Sadler's Wells. Pethas Moon, who's done very well with his first crop. Scarlo, Arrigo, tapping into that German blood again. It's a really diverse group, and you tend to keep a lot of these stallions on rotation between France and England and Ireland as well, and you send them to other studs in Yorkshire. You're always thinking outside the box. Just give me an indication as to what your policy for standing these stallions is.
You know, sometimes the British breeding gets a little bit of stick, which is slightly unfair, I think, because, you know, although I don't mean that in any chippy way, in it, because I'm really pleased, and I'm glad I'm situated in the UK, and I think we've got some great British breeders here. But we haven't got the numbers that for France and Ireland have a breed National horses. We haven't had the subsidies over the years, but we have done we've done a great job of where we've got to with Cave Tar and all different types of stallions. But one of the main things we believe in at Yorton is, and you have to remember, Yorton didn't exist 15 years ago, so we've gotten a massive big financial backing. We've sort of paddled our own canoe with it, so we have had to have we have had to sell some stallions at some stage, but also, there's a typical, you know, Molinas we owned with Ralph Barry, and he was always going to go to Ralph Barry at one time. And then you have Gentoave, who the Potter's family own. We bought him, and he stood here for 3 years. Then all of a sudden he's down to covering 25 mares. Well, financially, you can't stand a stallion covering 25 mares and make money. So we sent him out to France. He stood there for 2 years. We didn't sell him. We just leased him out there. He was covering 70 to 80 mares. We brought him back last year. His numbers are back up. He's back again here. So I think we do need to move them about. We brought Great Pretender over for 1 year. I was slightly disappointed, really. We brought Great Pretender over, and I said to Pascal, you know, what's it? I said, probably we'll cover 80 mares with him, I'd like to think, 70 to 80 mares. We covered 40 to 50. The British market didn't really get onto him. So, you know, we sent him back. But we like to move our stallions about. If they're not getting supported, if they're getting supported at home, we will leave them here. And if all of a sudden we're standing them here and they're not getting supported for whatever reason, it could be for many, many reasons, but then probably maybe a change somewhere else that gives the stallion another opportunity. Everything that goes on here at Yorkton is so exciting. We've got from, obviously, the stallions. We have a broodmare band of 60 or 70 mares. We've got the foaling going on. We have our own sale. We have Yorkton Racing, where we're putting horses into racing. I would love more and more people, and let Yorkton be open to more of the public and say, crikey, I would imagine a vast majority of people involved, the general public involved in racing, aren't that aware where the racehorses come from. And what we're doing every day is so exciting, and we need to show that out and showpiece that. I believe that we can showpiece that out, you know, to the general public and try and get some more people involved.
I mean, Dave, do you think it's realistic? Do you think it's feasible that you could get people who want to own horses into the game at an earlier stage so that they get in at the foal and yearling stage and actually see the whole production process through, rather than having to spend huge money buying horses that are, to all intents and purposes, ready-made? Do you actually think there would be an appetite for that, or are people just not patient enough?
Nick, I know there's an appetite for it, because we're already doing it in a small way, and it's something that I really want to expand. You know, if I was a young trainer starting off, or, you know, quite a smaller established trainer, or any trainer really, but, you know, you think, right, you have an owner come in and you could say, right, where are we going to compete, where are we going to get into, well, we can either jump in at the select point-to-point sale, blah blah blah, or we can do a little bit of that, and actually we could go up somewhere like Yorkton Farm. They've got some great stallions, they're good broodmare band. They're actually putting their money where their mouth is. They're putting their own horses in training. You know, we're probably the only national stud farm in the country that goes around buying stock from breeders who've supported them, putting them back into training with a fairly successful record. Hopefully we'll get better. But also they can bring their owner down and say, right, David, you know, have you got four foals for me or four yearlings? Yep. That's fine. We can sort you out where I think is going to suit you. This is the package. We can keep them here. If you haven't got the ground to take them on, we can keep them here. You can come down and see them. It's going to be an all-inclusive package. That's what it's going to be. And your trainer can go and take them on and pre-train them and do them. And the sooner we start racing our national hunt stock at 3 years old, I think long-term, we will really reap the benefit.
David Futter there from Yorkton Farm talking to Nick. And a reminder, you can check out all their stallions at the Wetherby's National Hunt Stallion Resource, nhstallions.co.uk.
Jane Mangan, all that's left is for you to send us away with a winning tip, if you don't mind. That would be very kind of you. Have you been in form of late on the Nick Cluck Daily with your tipping, Jane?
No, shocking. I'd say I haven't tipped a winner since before Cheltenham.
And that, you can view that one of two ways, Jane. Either you're due a winner, or you're not giving today's selection with a great deal of confidence. Where are you? You're due a winner.
Well, I'm going to give a selection for the Ancient Ground Nationals. So has anybody ever been confident?
It's easy. 40 runners. It's not difficult.
Not at all. I am going for any second now for Ted Walsh and JP McManus. JP has a number of chances in here, including Manila Times as well, and Annabelle Fly, but I think any second now. His win over 2 miles last time in the Webster Cup was something not a lot of horses in the lineup could be able to do, and he's just been set out for this race. He was laid out for the race last year. It was obviously cancelled, and I think Ted Walsh knows exactly what it takes to win around Aintree. He's got an incredible record in the race for the horses that he runs, and any second now fits a lot of profiles for me. And just down the bottom, if you're lightweight, Secret Reprieve, just listening or reading the quotes of Evan Williams, he needs 3 horses to come out. He's got James Bowen booked. Secret Reprieve is a classy horse on the up. He's a 7-year-old. He's got ticks a lot of boxes. But if my money's going anywhere, it's going on any second now. And best of luck if you're getting involved.
You put up 2 for the grand. So you're very confident. That's very brave indeed. Secret Reprieve, hopefully getting a run. And any second now for Ted Walsh on what would have been last year, the 20th anniversary of Papillon. But it wasn't to be without a race. But he's looking to win it again. Jane, a pleasure as always. Thank you very much. You need a day with the feet up, I think, Jane, after 3 days at Fairy.
Oh, you've never been to my house, Tom.
Not possible.
It wouldn't be long we getting a kick.
Jane Manger, thank you very much indeed. Thanks, everyone, for listening to this week's podcast. If you like what you heard today or any other day, don't forget to rate, review and subscribe. Nick, back tomorrow. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Nick Luck Daily, brought to you in association with FitzDares, the Racehorse Owners Association and Thoroughbred Racing Commentary. Thank you.